It seems most fitting, ladies and gentlemen, that this gathering be held in this edifice, the Carnegie Endowment Center, which is dedicated to the promotion of peace among the nations of the world. Can any of us doubt that in this chaotic day in which we live, in which fear fills the hearts of so many millions of people throughout the world, change is very desperately needed. Our distinguished guest is very much loved and admired wherever followers of the Baha'i religion reside. And today that is in 256 countries and territories throughout the world. As the former Mary Maxwell, she was born here in New York City. But she spent her early life in Montreal, Canada. As a young girl, she traveled extensively in Europe and in the Middle East, having visited the Holy Land twice in those travels before she was married in 1937 to Shoghi Effendi Rabbani, the world head of the Baha'i religion. And thereafter she made her home in Haifa, Israel, at the foot of Mount Carmel, in the shadow of the Cave of Elijah, where the holy prophets of the past walked in the early days. In 1952, Madame Rabbani was appointed by Shoghi Effendi as a member of the International Baha'i Council, which has its seat in the Holy Land. In 1957, our guardian, Shoghi Effendi Rabbani, passed away, but Mrs. Rabbani continued to live in Haifa, where she serves as one of the 9 members of the international body which directs the affairs of the Baha'i world faith throughout the world. Besides traveling extensively on behalf of the Baha'i faith, Madame Rabbani has written a great deal on universal subjects. One of her best known works is Prescription for Living, which was published in England in 1950. Madame Rabbani is a distinguished daughter of distinguished parents, her father having been Mr. Sutherland Maxwell, famous and noted architect who designed the Chateau Frontenac in Montreal, as well as the majestic shrine of the Bab on Mount Carmel in the Holy Land. Her mother, Mrs. May Bowles Maxwell, was one of the early Baha'i believers and teachers who made frequent visits to Europe and to South America, where she passed on and is buried. The subject of tonight's address will be Changing Needs in a Changing World. And I am deeply honored to present Madame Ruhia Rabbani.
Mr. Chairman, friends, it's a great pleasure for me to be here in the city of my birth for some unknown reason, although I haven't spent very much time in my life in New York. I've always proudly said that I was a New Yorker, that I was born in New York and I was a New Yorker. Of course, at this period in my life, I've become so many things, a Persian subject as well as an American subject and a Canadian citizen until I was 21. And I think perhaps I'm beginning to qualify for a citizen of the world. I hope so, in any case. I think that perhaps most of you are familiar with many of the teachings of the Baha'i Faith. But naturally, that does not mean that all of you are. And so what I'm going to speak about tonight will perhaps be of interest to Baha'is and non-Baha'is and people who are somewhat familiar with our teachings and people who have never heard of them before. The founder of our faith, Baha'u'llah, made a very wonderful statement. He said that all men have been created to carry forward an ever-advancing civilization. That, of course, makes us ponder on where we find ourselves today. As Mr. Kaplan said, people are deeply disturbed today because of the conditions of the whole world, because of the national furor that goes on, because of prejudices, because of antagonisms, and above all, because of the terrible threat hanging over our heads. We are not sure what the future holds. It can hold international catastrophe. On the other hand, it can hold a very marvelous future for all men. The Baha'is believe that the near future is very dark, but the distant future is very bright. How dark the near future is, we do not know. But we feel it convinced that to the degree to which all men of goodwill strive together to bring about a wonderful distant future, that present and immediate future will be shortened and its dangers to some extent avoided. I think that we all realize today that we are living in a neighborhood. We used to live far apart from each other, but now we all live very close to each other. When I first went to the East as a child of 12, it was a tremendous experience for me at last to stand in front of the pyramids and to see the Sphinx. I had come almost halfway around the world. I had traveled by ship for over 10 days to France, and then we had loitered in France for some time, and we traveled 2 weeks over to Port Said and disembarked and gone up by train to Cairo, and then we'd gotten out somehow or other to the pyramids, and I got on a camel and I went out and I at last saw the Sphinx. It was all very romantic and fascinating. The last time, before, of course, last war broke out, the last time that I went from Egypt to Europe, I left the pyramids in the morning. I'd been staying in a hotel, Nina House, opposite them. And in the afternoon, I got off in the drizzling rain of Paris. And all the romance was shattered. This tremendous sense of distance, of traveling to distant parts, and seeing strange people in strange ways was gone forever. And, of course, we have the great advantage that one world will bring us. If we are all closely united, if we can build a proper world together, we stand to benefit from it immensely, and above all, the millions of people who have been in such desperate poverty and live, as we know, on the hunger line, borderline of hunger all the time, these people can and will undoubtedly benefit immensely from a unified world. The fact remains, whether we regret the passing of a very romantic period which is gone forever, whether we are afraid of the future, whatever we think it holds, nevertheless, we all live in a neighborhood nowadays. Technical progress has brought this about. The degree to which science has advanced in the last 100 years or so is, as we all know, a little short of miraculous. It has made so much possible for the human race, and it has also brought with it such great dangers to all of us. The trouble with the world today, I think every intelligent person agrees, especially those people who are concerned with trying to better the conditions of the human race, such as educators and priests and clergymen and leaders in any field of progressive thought. The great trouble with us is that we have not progressed morally and spiritually. We have progressed physically, Now we find ourselves next door neighbors, but we have not the moral equipment which is necessary for us to live together in anything even approaching peace. This seems to be the next step that we have to take. In the meantime, this extraordinary technical process, this remarkable advance that science has made, has brought us to a very dangerous impasse. Baha'u'llah realized this, and over 70 years ago, he made a very astonishing statement. He said, "The civilization so often vaunted by the learned exponents of arts and sciences will, if allowed to overleap the bounds of moderation, bring great evil upon men. If carried to excess, civilization will prove as prolific a source of evil as it has been of goodness when kept within the restraints of moderation. The day is approaching when its flame will devour the cities." It's very strange that he should have said that so long ago. And speaking myself as a Baha'i who was brought up always a Baha'i, I never was anything else. My parents were Baha'is and I was always raised in this faith. I think that the import of that statement never really sunk into the heads of the Baha'is until the last World War. Then we ourselves suddenly remembered why Baha'u'llah made this extraordinary statement over 70 years ago. And now, for the first time, it is possible to realize it in the most terrible sense. It is possible to destroy the cities with our civilization. This world that we live in, which is becoming so small and yet is so barbaric in many of its instincts at the present time, is complicated, I think, by another factor, another thing which we must pause to consider, and that is the awakening of the so-called backward people of the world. Suddenly, we highly civilized people of the West find ourselves next door to people of an entirely different background. Of course, we have people of great culture, such as the Chinese and the Hindus, the Indian civilizations, the civilizations of the Far East, perhaps in many ways much more advanced than our own. And we also find ourselves brought in contact with what we choose to call the primitive or backward peoples of the world. Somehow, we have got to learn to amalgamate with these people. We have got to find a bridge between their present state, coming out of tribal conditions of living, coming from religions which are different from our own, in many ways, I would say, just as good, and perhaps embodying some of the great principles which we think we monotheistic religions such as Judaism and Christianity and Islam have a monopoly on. In any case, these people now are being plunged into this world of ours, and we have to think very seriously what we are going to do with them, how we are going to educate them, how we are going to draw them into the councils of man, make them feel at home, help them to be educated without destroying their past and their characteristics, which I believe can be of great help to all the other people in this world. It's a very interesting subject. It's not the subject of my talk, and we can't go into it. But I think people would do well to ponder what we, when I say we, I mean Western civilization, we people of this Western civilization which is predominating in the world today, what we think we can do with these backward people to bring them into our world without destroying them and without having them cause some destruction to us. Of course, we all know what's going on in South Africa. I'm not going to talk about that tonight either. But these are some of the problems facing us, and I'm sure we are all aware of them. And they are interesting and important problems. What people need in the world today, we Baha'is believe, is a common denominator. We need something that will enable all of us to live together in some degree of peace and understanding without constantly caviling against the other man and saying your religion is wrong, your system is wrong, your past is wrong, your color is wrong. I think that one of the greatest crimes that the white race has committed, and I have every right to say so because, of course, I'm obviously white myself, is that we have gone to people in different parts of this world and had the audacity to make them believe that they were wrong because they were a different color from us, that there are different classes of passengers on the planet, that we are the first-class passengers, there are some second and third class, and that the fourth class are these dark-skinned races, and, as I said before, so-called primitive people. It is probably one of the greatest crimes that any man can commit against another man, to blame him for the color and the race that God created in him. This surely is the blackest of sins in my estimation. Now, what we need is something that will do away with these prejudices and that will draw all men together. Something, as I said, that is a common denominator and upon which they can all agree. It is very strange that the answer to that problem should have come out of Persia in the last century. I remember once talking to a very distinguished Harvard professor, and he asked me a little bit about what the Baha'i faith was, and I answered him briefly. I didn't wish to thrust my ideas upon him. And then he said, well, did you have to go so far away to find a belief? Couldn't you have accepted something a little nearer home? Did you have to go to Persia to find a religion? And I said, doctor, he was a medical doctor, I want to ask you a question. If in Persia they find a cure for cancer, will you say that you are not going to accept it because it comes from Persia, it has to come from near home? Of course, that shut him up. There was no more discussion. The whole keynote of Baha'u'llah's message is world peace and world brotherhood. We believe that there is evolution in the physical world and that there is also a spiritual form of evolution which takes place in the development of the human race as human beings. Of course, obviously, our bodies are animal. Our past, in the sense that we are part of the physical world, is an animal past. But I presume most of the people in this room believe that we are human beings also, and that that implies some divine spark, some higher faculty than those possessed by animals. What we feel is the whole process of human evolution is that we have always been given an education by our Creator, that this education was suited to the stage of development in which humanity found itself at different periods in its history. In other words, it's like a child that goes to school. When it goes to first grade school, it gets the kind of teachings that it requires. When it goes to higher grades, it gets a much higher degree of education. The thoughts are more advanced. The principles involved are more complicated and so on. And, of course, eventually it gets to university. Now, you would not say that a professor who taught first grade and high school students and university students didn't always possess all the things in his own mind. He has to adapt what he says to the minds of his hearers. He has to give out what that particular class can accept at its age. And I think that that is probably the best example of what we Baha'is believe is the process of spiritual evolution in this world. In other words, we believe that God, the Heavenly Father of all men, has always sent us what we like to call divine educators. You can call them prophets, you can call them anything that suits you, but the fact remains that we have had these marvelous and inspiring, and we Baha'is believe, divine educators who have guided us at different periods in human history. Undoubtedly, there have been some whose names are lost in antiquity. It stands to reason it couldn't have suddenly begun at some arbitrary period. There must have always been this process going on. There always will be the same process. And so we believe that Zoroaster and Buddha and Muhammad and Jesus Christ and Baha'u'llah in this age are divine educators sent to guide men and to give them an ever greater degree of truth suited to the needs of the age in which these great men appear. En passant, I would like to say that the Baha'is believe as much about Jesus Christ as the Christians do. And we have teachings which I would say surpass many of the present things taught in some of the more liberal Christian churches about Christ. You cannot be a Baha'i without believing in the station of Jesus Christ. So there is no conflict on that subject between us and other people, nor for that matter between us and the people of any faith. All that we feel, as I said, is that we are being given an unfolding measure of truth suited to our needs. We know that there never was a world before. All these divine educators appeared at periods when there were either nations or empires. And, of course, people didn't have any of the benefits of modern science. The world of the past was infinitely remote from the world that we know in the 20th century. Suddenly, during the last century, and, of course, to a greater extent in the last 60 years of this century, we have had this immense development in the field of science. And before that, after the time of Christ and after the time of Muhammad, we had the discovery of the Western Hemisphere, which completed the world. And since then, we've had this great scientific growth, which has brought the world so close. In view of that, we say that what we need today is a message for the whole world. Of course, all truth from God must be the same truth. There can't be two kinds of truth. There can only be one kind. Therefore, the fundamental teachings of all these great beings that come to educate us are the same. They all teach the Golden Rule. They all teach the Ten Commandments. They all set a marvelous example in their personal lives. They teach us immortality. They teach us the value of prayer, and so on. All these fundamentals are unchanging. But the direct teachings, which are suitable for the position in which a group of people, or at this time the human race, finds itself, are different according to the period of history in which they appear. And so what we needed in this day was the universal truth. And the whole emphasis of Baha'u'llah's teachings is on the oneness of mankind, bringing about human unity on this planet and brotherhood, and abolishing war and establishing universal and lasting peace. That is really the primary objective of the Baha'i faith. That is what we Baha'is are working for, as Mr. Cavelin said, in over 256 countries at the present time. Baha'u'llah said that religion should be a force of unity in the world, that if it wasn't, we'd better not to have any religion. And I think that we can agree with that principle very easily. He also said that the most important thing is to abolish, through a process naturally of education and through association, which opens people's eyes to each other as nothing else does, the terrible prejudices that divide people in this day: racial prejudice, religious prejudice, and national prejudice. He emphasized very strongly that in the society of the future, we would have to abolish the extremes of wealth and poverty. And it's very interesting to see that all of these things, which he said over 70 years ago, are being accepted by intelligent people everywhere. Even American society now, through high taxation of certain groups, income groups, and through increased social service to the poor, is working towards this thing that Baha'u'llah said, the abolition of the extremes of wealth and poverty. Another thing that the Baha'i faith teaches is, of course, the equality of men and women, and that science and religion should go hand in hand. Speaking of the equality of men and women, we have a great many visitors come to our Baha'i gardens and shrine in Haifa on the side of Mount Carmel. And one of our friends there was giving a short talk so that the people would know who was buried there and the purpose of it and a few of the ideas of the Baha'is. And there were a group of American tourists gathered around him. And when he had finished, he had stressed all of these different things that I'm mentioning and the equality of men and women, that this was the day when there must be absolute equality between men and women. And one of these American men came up to him and he said, "Brother, I wish you'd come and teach this in America. We need it." So it seems that the American man now has to struggle for his rights
I was very amused by that. Of course, obviously, we believe in universal suffrage and in education for all, that everybody must be educated. There is an interesting sidelight on that in our faith. Abdu'l-Bahá, the son of the founder of the Baha'i faith, said that if you were forced to take a choice, and you had a daughter and a son, and you could only afford, really, to give one of them a good education, that you should give it to the girl, because she would be the educator of the next generation. In other words, the child learns at the knee of its mother. If the mother is enlightened, if the mother is liberal, if the mother is spiritual, if the mother is God-fearing, and so on, the child will be all of those things if he has a good mother. And he was so convinced of the importance of this that he said, well, if you have to take a choice, and of course, naturally, we hope nobody ever has to, that the mother, the future mother, the woman, should have the preference and receive the better education. We believe that we must have, in the future, a world government, that this is the only thing that is going to solve the problems of mankind. We know that we had once upon a time the League of Nations. It was born under an unlucky star, and it wallowed around, and it didn't solve all the problems of the world, and in the end we had this last terrible war. Nevertheless, it was a tremendous step forward in human history. It was the first time that on the planet any federation, any effort at drawing people together to discuss the affairs of the world had been made. After the last war, of course, we had the United Nations, and the United Nations is much better than nothing. But I am sure that all of us wish that it were a more perfect thing than it is, that it had more true power to unite men and to hold nations in check and thus protect the entire human race. Abdu'l-Bahá, when he was in this country, made it very clear that the best principle that we could follow in producing in the future some form of world government was the same principle that the United States has. In other words, we have the states of the Union, which have a great deal of autonomy and independence. They can have, for instance, life imprisonment or the death penalty. They have their individual laws inside the state with quite a lot of latitude. But when it comes to protecting the Union, the whole nation, then the federal government steps in and takes care of the country as a whole and in major issues of the rights of the people living in that country as a whole. And Abdu'l-Bahá said that this was a very marvelous system and that he thought that it would be the best system to adopt in the future to produce some form of control in the whole world. And that federal system probably will come into being. How soon, of course, we have no way of knowing. It doesn't seem very difficult to understand that if we had that protection, we would not constantly have this threat of war hanging over our heads. We believe that we must have eventually a universal police force, but that, of course, would be the ideal thing if we had a federated government of the world and a police force that was supported by all the nations of the world and would hold recalcitrant members of the Federation under control and prevent war from breaking out. As I said, whether we're going to be able to have that without any more agony, I really don't know. But I do know that to the degree to which we work for things, we are liable to get results. And that sitting down and just saying, well, let Joe do it, isn't going to solve any of the problems in this world. Joe, if you really think about it, is yourself. There isn't any other Joe to do it. It always comes back to you. Everything is as good as the parts that it is composed of. Society can't possibly be any better than each one of us because we are the ingredients of society. If we work on ourselves, we will find that we are working on the whole. It's our only direct method of changing society is to change ourselves. In fact, we can't change anything else because I'm sure that most of you are parents and you know you can't even change your own children. You try, you do anything in the world to live your child's life, you give them advice, You know that if they do a certain thing, they're going to suffer to such and such a degree because you did it yourself once. But it doesn't seem to work. Ultimately, of course, you can teach the children the right thing. You can give them a good education. And above all, you can give them a good example. But they have to live their own lives. Therefore, it always adds up to the same thing, that the only thing you really can affect in this world is yourself. That's about all you have under your immediate control is yourself. Of course, lots of us haven't got ourselves under control, but it's better than nothing. I reached the point where my arms aren't long enough. And I got these lorgnettes for an emergency, and the emergency has now arrived, and I'll see if I can use them. It's their inauguration. Yes, I can find it. You know, last week, there was a very, very fine article in Life. I never read it, but as I've been spending half of my time on airplanes lately, I've had more chance to read things like that. There's an article called The National Purpose. And I would think that any intelligent American would do well to read it. It's a very, very thoughtful article. And it impressed me so much that I wanted to read a couple of excerpts here. What do you do with these things? The critical weakness, this is Walter Lippmann, the critical weakness of our society is that for the time being, our people do not have great purposes, which they are united in wanting to achieve. The public mood of the country is defensive, to hold on and to conserve, not to push forward and to create. We talk about ourselves these days as if we were a completed society, one which has achieved its purposes and has no further great business to transact. Then the author of this article, I'm not sure who he is, I think he's one of the editors of Life, goes on to say, but the United States has hitherto been a country associated with great purpose. If that purpose is now absent, we are not what we were. Is there not a connection between the rise of nations and great purposes, between the loss of purpose and their decline? As I said, I think it is one of the most thought-provoking articles I have ever read. And perhaps many Americans reading that would feel discouraged. The truth of the remarks in it is obvious to all. But I don't think that they should feel discouraged, because I don't believe that America is a nation that has lost its vision and forgotten its great purpose. We Baha'is believe that America has a unique destiny to fulfill in the world at this time. We believe, and it says explicitly so in our teachings, that America is destined to usher in world peace, that is her mission. She is more fitted to do it than any other nation in the whole world for many, many reasons. Perhaps one of the reasons, and in a way it's a sad reason, is that she is the wealthiest country in the whole world. And her wealth has given her tremendous prominence. Another reason, undoubtedly, is because she was the champion of freedom for so long, and for equal rights of men. That great past has also fitted her mentally to lead the world forward to its destiny of peace, because we've got to have peace or we're not going to have any world left, one or the other. But I think a third reason that has fitted America for this wonderful destiny is that the American people have the capacity to believe. When I was in Germany before the war, I knew a man who was a Nazi. Most people were, you know. And he happened to be a high-ranking SS man. He'd been in the previous war, and I think that was one reason that had made him become a Nazi, because he was so afraid of the trains in his country, and he thought probably that this was the solution to the problem, which, of course, we know was not. In any case, he was a prominent man, a wealthy man, and he invited me out to dinner one night with some friends of his. And I thought it was very ill-advised. In the middle of this dinner, he said, Mary, tell them what you believe. Well, I said, I don't think they'd be interested in what I believe. No, he said, go on, please. Tell them what you believe. Tell them your thoughts. And so, as briefly as I could, because I thought it was rather out of place, I told them just what I have said now about the ideas of the Baha'i Faith, what we are working to establish, that we believe there will be peace, that the future is bright, that we can establish peace, that we have reached the point where mankind can and will be unified in this day because it's part of its destiny, and so on. And he turned around to his friends with the most puzzled look on his face, and he said, "Sie glaubt es." She believes it. This was the great phenomena. He wasn't the least interested in what I had said, neither were they. But the white elephant, the unicorn, the dodo, was that I actually believed what I said. That was the phenomena. That was what they were to look at me and take note of. And that is true of us on this in this part of the world. It is true of the North Americans. It is a North American characteristic. There is something in us, I don't know whether it's because we came out here as pioneers from countries where we were persecuted or we didn't have equality or we didn't like the church or whatever it was a restless lot that came out and settled this part of the world. And then, of course, we conquered this continent. And we made it what it is today, and we made it through belief, through a get-up-and-go and conviction that anything was possible. We could do it, and we would do it. And I think that that marvelous thing that is in the hearts of the people in North America is the thing that is going to enable us to establish world peace. Because we people believe that it can be done. We often get discouraged, we get furious, we get all wound up by the things we read in the papers all the time, we get into a lather about it, we don't know which way to turn. But I'm sure that there is more per capita conviction in this part of the world that we can and will have peace, and that there is a way to have it, than in all the rest of the world put together. And that is the force which, combined, as I said, with our great prestige and our national wealth and many other things which we should thank God that we do possess, is going to enable us, I think, to establish world peace. In the course of my trip, I have had a very interesting experience, and I would like to share it with you because I sincerely believe this. It has affected me very profoundly, and I think it is right, and I think consequently I should speak of it. I went out, of course, to visit the Baha'i centers, as you have heard, and I've met in so far the last 5 weeks over 3,000 Baha'is in different places. But in the course of these travels, I went out to the Indian reservation of the Hopi Indians, which are in the middle of the Navajo reservation. I also met with the Navajo Council of Chiefs, which meets quarterly, their Congress, in other words. And I met with some Indians in Canada, the Pagan Indians, the Blackfoot Indians on the Pagan Reserve. And I began to get entirely different ideas. I found these people a very fine people, but so downtrodden and so shy of my race after all the things that have happened to them, and I'm sorry to say, which are happening, because I think that people who are interested in this subject will bear me out that bad as is the treatment of the American Negro in regards to employment and many other ways of discriminating against him, this plight of the American Indian is worse. Of course, he is the ward of the government. If he stays on the plantation, he's protected. On the reservation, he's protected, and he is educated if he wants to be, and he goes to hospitals free of charge, and so on. But when he comes out into our world, and after all, our world exists around him, he's a tiny minority now on this continent. When he comes out into our world, he is very severely discriminated against as dirty Indian. And these people have reached a point where practically all of the ones that I met, and I met quite a few and had an opportunity to speak to them and with them, will not look you in the face until they feel through that little seismograph that they have inside of them. They get vibrations very quickly. They feel that you have no feeling against them, that there's no prejudice in your heart. When they discover that, then they begin to look you in the face. Of course, I don't like that. That makes me feel horrible. It upset me very much. Another thing that I found about these Indians, which touched me very deeply, was that when we went onto the reservation, we had Baha'is living in different places on these Indian reservations amongst the Indians. Some of them have been adopted into the tribe.
They said, oh, you mustn't lock anything up. And, of course, we were traveling. We had furs and, you know, cameras and luggage and all kinds of things thrown around in the car. And when we said, aren't you going to lock the car? They said, oh, no, nobody ever locks anything up on the reservation. They would be very, very hurt because nothing is ever stolen on the reservation. Well, that was a great eye-opener to me, too, because the people are terribly, terribly poor. Really poor. The children are in rags, and they have very poor diet and so on. And then, in the course of my visit to the Hopis and talking to the chiefs, I heard something which seemed to me unbelievable, but which evidently is true, because the Baha'is who were living there knew that it was so, and the Hopi chiefs themselves told me. They have uranium in their soil and oil, and they have refused to have it exploited as long as there is any danger that it could be used for human destruction. Do you know any other people that have that attitude towards the untold wealth that uranium represents? I don't. It astonished me. Now, I think that people with the characteristics and the background of these people, and they are very prayerful people. They believe in prayer, as I think most of us white people have forgotten it. And they turn to God and pray deeply and profoundly. When they are ill, they want to go back and have the prayers with the tribe to get better again, and often they are healed through these prayers. And a lot of other things which I can't go into now. But I think that if we would consider that the thing that the world needs most is some basic recognition of the fact that we are all created by one God and that we are one human family. Of course, we're very diversified, but there's no harm in that. The flowers in a garden are diverse too, and that's what gives them their charm. If we would take this great teaching to heart, that now, for the first time, we have one world, and the thing that we must have is a principle by which we can live together. And then you carry that a step further, and you ask yourself, what is it primarily that is preventing people from living together in the world and getting along as neighbors? And then you carry that thought a step further, and you say, the thing that is keeping us apart is prejudice, whether it is racial or religious, or national, or ideological, whatever it is. It is prejudice of the most violent kind, which leads to hatred, which is dividing the people of the world from each other in this day. And then you go a step further in your reasoning, and you say, well, surely if you strike at the greatest evil, the root in any particular community, in tearing that up by the root, so to speak, you will do away with a lot of minor prejudices too, because you will air their minds, so to speak, and air their souls, and in getting rid of a whopping big prejudice, they're liable to take out a few small ones along with it. I believe that that is true. I believe that when you go to your physician, if you have cancer, he's not going to waste time trying to cure the cold in the head that you may have or do something about your sore throat. He's going to get busy on your cancer. And I think that if we would get busy in our minds on the worst prejudice that we have in America because of the greatness of America, because of the greatness of her destiny, if we would struggle against this root prejudice, which is racial in this country, we would find that we attracted to ourselves just by a spiritual law. Everything is governed by laws. There's no reason why these other values shouldn't have laws that govern them too. We would find we attracted to us a greater degree of spiritual power and the blessings of Almighty God. And I am quite convinced of that. I think that there are two categories of prejudice in this world. There are people who, for reasons which I don't profess to understand and certainly can't spend time trying to analyze now, have an evil and deep-seated prejudice against whatever it may be. Sometimes it's Chinese prejudice, sometimes it's against the Negro, sometimes against the Indian, sometimes against everybody. But they have a deep-seated prejudice in their heart. And if they will make an effort to get over that prejudice and to demonstrate this great principle of the brotherhood of man,
I believe that they will have a tremendous reaction in the world. There are, as I said, two categories of prejudice, the deep-seated evil one and the superficial one. And it has been my experience, and I've spent a great many years studying this and a great many years in this field, that people who have what I call a secondary racial prejudice, a superficial one, react healthily to any demonstration of this great principle of the brotherhood of man. Of course, it's also taught by Jesus Christ, incidentally. But nevertheless, there is an immediate reaction to it, because they know it is right and they know it is sound. And often it's our own cowardice that prevents us from doing away with a lot of these veils, so to speak, over the eyes of our fellow citizens. We could do a great deal of good in this world if we consciously made an effort to do away with this terrible prejudice that is in this country. You know what is going on in South Africa, and there's no use talking about it because we all read the newspapers. But I sometimes wonder whether the American people realize how much they are looked up to abroad and how much people long to have America live up to what they believe she is and could be. And every time they find that she falls down, as we do nationally on this subject of prejudice, there is a wave of disillusionment abroad. People suffer from it. They feel that this big brother, who is so generous, because the American people are so proverbially generous, we give as no people do in the whole world, and we not only give money, but we give our hearts with the money. And the people abroad know that, and they love America for it. And it brings forth a great wave of affection for the American people. And then the next day, of course, comes out something more about Little Rock, and something more about this kind of a prejudice and that kind of a prejudice, and demonstrations of it here nationally, and that again disillusions people and gives our enemies scope and makes them very happy. And it's most unfortunate. So that it seems to me that one way that all of us can have a direct effect on helping our country to achieve its destiny is to struggle at this great root prejudice that exists in this country. And I hope you'll forgive me for saying this, but it comes of a very, very profound conviction. I have seen on this trip that I have made a light in people's eyes when they saw a group of Baha'is. Of course, we do have many mixed races in our community, come into an airport, go into a restaurant, come out of a lecture hall together, wherever they saw the races together, associating uprightly as human beings, all the children of one father, there was a reaction for the good in the faces of people. And as I went from here to Atlanta, Dallas, Gallup, you know, all up the Pacific coast and back through the north of Canada, and now down here, I think that I must have seen a little bit of the reaction in this country. And believe me, when you do the right thing, you get the right reaction, and you set great forces in motion. Baha'u'llah gave us a very wonderful word. He said, "Let not a man glory in this that he loves his country. Rather, let him glory in this that he loves his kind." That does not mean that we mustn't love our country, but we must have, as this article wonderfully points out in time, we must have, in life, we must have a love for our country that goes out into the future and foresees her role and her part and helps her attain the great destiny which I think God has in store for America.
I am told that no smoking is permitted in this hall, so please, anyone who is smoking, refrain from doing so. This is a fire regulation. I won't attempt, friends, to express our gratitude to Madame Rabbani for this inspiring and illuminating address. I think she demonstrates so eloquently not only the equality of the sexes, but the superiority of the female of the species. The applause came from the men, ladies and gentlemen. Madame Rabbani will be very pleased to answer any questions which the audience may have if you will write the question and send it forward. The ushers will present pads to those who wish to write questions, and they will be brought forward to the platform and given to Madame Rabbani for her replies. If you'll raise your hand, those of you who would like to ask questions, you'll be given a pad by the ushers.